Well, thank you very much indeed, Mr. Guard, for letting us come and talk to you again. Could you just, for the tape, give us your name and your date of birth, please?
Well, my name is Hilary Frances Guard. My mother was determined I was going to be a girl, so I had girls' names, which had been a curse all my life. And I was born on the 21st of March, 1913.
Thank you very much.
And that happened to be on a Good Friday, and I came in with the hot cross buns.
Thank you, Mr. Guard. And my name is John Beckerson. It's the 14th of October, 1998, and we're in Mr. Guard's home on Selborne Drive. Well, Mr. Guard, I wondered if you could just give me a quick synopsis of your distinguished career in the boarding house trade, and tell me how you first came into it, and then how it developed from there.
Well, all my life I've been very active, and very, very rarely stayed in hotels because I really wasn't fit to stop in a hotel. I used to go camping, and I had a garage in Stourbridge, and I came up for 2 days' holiday, and I came up in the car, and I was going to Dublin for 2 days, and they wouldn't take me on the Dublin boat, apparently because I hadn't camped on the landing stage for 2 days and two nights. So I went up to the little kiosk, the Isle of Man steam packet, and I got on the Isle of Man steam packet boat, and we disappeared out of the bar, and the Dublin boat was still there, so they could have taken me on. And I was tootling along the promenade, a beautiful summer's day, and the shore was like Blackpool, thousands of people on it, and blue sky, and the sea was like glass. And all the boarding houses on the promenade in those days, I believe by law, were compelled to be the same colour, which was white, and it looked like the Bay of Naples. It was marvellous. And I thought to myself, what on earth, what are these people that are allowed to live here in this paradise? And I stopped halfway along the promenade at a boarding house called the Grasmere. And the vestibule doors all were open in the sun, but I rang the bell because somebody came to the door, a young lady came to the door, and I said quickly to her, can I have a single room, please, for 2 nights? Of course you can't, she said. She didn't even bother to think about it. To go there in August, ask for single rooms on the promenade in those days, and of course I didn't know. Well, I said, are you the proprietor? She said, no. Well, I said, who is? Well, she said, we won't help you at all. Well, I said, can I see the proprietress? And she came out. And my father, apparently, father and mother used to come to the Isle of Man nearly every year and take us when we were children. They knew the proprietor, who was a Mr. Matthews and a Mrs. Matthews. And she said to me, is your name Guard? I said, yes. I said, how did you know? Because I'd no idea that you knew. Well, she said, you're the image of your father. Well, I said, good heavens. Anyway, I said, what I want to know is if you can give me a single room for the 2 nights, and I won't give you any trouble. I don't drink. I'm not interested in girls and so on, which I wasn't in those days, I suppose. Anyway, the upshot of it was I got in there for 2 days, and that's how I started in the boarding house business or the hotel business, and there was a girl there, and apparently what impressed me was that I was in the room on the second floor the first night, and the top floor on the second night, and I used to be on inspection in the old days, and inspecting to 1/10000th of an inch on equipment for the bombers and one thing or another. And you get to looking at things without really thinking you're looking. And I remember putting out my swimming costume on the sill when the window was open. But first of all, I tested the windowsill to see if there was any dirt on it before I put my wet swimming costume on it. And it was clean. I thought, that's amazing. So I put my hand under the window, and that was clean. So I put my hand on the top of the wardrobe, and that was clean. There was no fluff under the bed. And I put my hand as the final test over the top of the door when it was opened. And it came as clean as when I first started. And then I found out that this girl did all the bedrooms in the house, 27. And she helped out her mother as well. I hadn't seen her. And I thought, well, I'm going to stop in and see this girl. She must be a wonder. And I was on the top floor, which is room 27. And there was a knock on the door. Of course, there was no locks on the doors in those days. And I was standing about a couple of feet inside the door. And the door was just knocked and opened. Not anybody there, because everybody was out except me. And it was the girl, you see. And by God, she was gorgeous. And I thought to myself, that's a girl I'm going to marry. And I stopped there for a week. And I met the mother and her when the season was finished in Liverpool. And I ran them down to Kent for their holidays. Anyway, that's how it all started. And she was without anybody to manage the hotel. Her son-in-law and daughter, who'd been helping her since the war, had taken a hotel on their own, you see. So anyway, I came and helped to manage. And we were there for 12 years. And
that was, you weren't actually married, you were just there, were you courting?
Well, after the first year, we married. And this year, on the 29th of October, we celebrate our 50th anniversary. So it must be 50 years ago that we got married. And I looked upon the 12 years, really, that I was in the Grasmere as a time when I learnt the business and the different facets of it. But we always had high tea there. Now, I was looking round for a bigger place, because after 3 years, we'd reached the absolute maximum capacity. When we were open, and we only booked from Saturday to Saturday to Saturday, and we took 68 people, and invariably we had 68 people in from beginning to the end. And at that time, I made a note of it, we received up to 60 letters a day. And I was learning the business the hard way. I expect I made mistakes and one thing and another. But I started from the top of the house. Now, invariably, if you go to a hotel, the higher you go, the worse it gets. And I always thought that the people who are at the top deserve the best, because they've got the toughest job climbing up. And also, I thought I'd like to give them the standard that I'd like myself. I mean, having been in the business for 30 years, I found that a number of hoteliers and boarding house people in their little flat down below, there was absolute luxury, fantastic. And when you got to the top floor, it was dreadful. But their quarters, they knew what they wanted. And then I thought, well, if I'm going to learn this business and get the place full, I've got to find out what fills it. And I didn't look at the idiots along the terrace, so there's quite a few. And I looked at the people who were successful, who were full when other people were empty. And I studied them. And I found out that one of the main things was good food and plenty of it. And cleanliness was another thing. And then I learned other things as I went along. And, of course, the experiences that you get in a hotel over 30 years, I don't know whether you've heard of Kinsey, the fellow who wrote about sex in America or did. Well, I tell you, he knew nothing as to what goes on in hotels. And I determined that I must have a bigger place, because we wouldn't take enough money, profit, to educate the children properly. I wanted them to go to college, which I would have loved to have done. Tom Brown School Day has always intrigued me. and all that sort of business, and I thought it'd be wonderful if they did that. And there's no way I could afford it in this place. And I was looking out for a big place.
Can you remember what sort of money the Grasmere would be making in profit at the end of a year in those days? Or was it not something you calculated?
Well, looking back, I seem to remember that we took gross about £6,000, you see. And you can say at least a third of that would go on food. And then there was the rent and rates and staff, heating and lighting. So I suppose, looking at it, I should say about £1,000 a year. In those days, that was 50 years ago, which is quite a long while, because £1,000 would be a lot more. And I realised that I couldn't possibly work any harder than I did. And if I had a bigger place, I couldn't work any harder, just have to mean I'd have to get more staff, you see. And then the Dorrick, as it was then called, came off a stay, which is a big hotel, and they took about 150, 180.
What's it called now? Or is it gone?
I don't know. I don't think it's there now. And I was kind of tempted to I was offered it, I could have had it. And the wife said to me, if you take that, I'm going to leave you. She was terrified at the thought of what it did mean, you see. And so I had to give up the idea. Meanwhile, I'd got very friendly with a gentleman called Jack Bredner, who had the hydro at the other end of the terrace. Now, the hydro was in one of the best positions on the promenade because it was on a corner site, and when the sun came up in the morning, it illuminated more than half the bedrooms along the side and the front, and the sun wasn't at its strength, so it didn't fade the curtains or anything like that. And it was there when the people got up. On the other end of the terrace, when the sun got round again, it got very, very hot, and it faded all the curtains and the furniture, and it didn't do the visitors any good because they weren't in, you see. And also, the hydro, there was only one other hotel on the whole length of the promenade which had five floors of the bedrooms. It had five floors of bedrooms. And I was feeding Mr. Bredner with any amount of letters each week. Odd dates, because you get a lot of people who inquire odd dates, and I didn't want to do those. And he got a considerable amount of business from that. And during the course of a year or so, we struck up a friendship, and he said to me that I would have first refusal of the hydro when it came up for sale. And I got first refusal, and we got into the hydro. And I must say, we opened up with a kind of a conference, which was before opening in the main season, could have been at Easter, just for the few days. And it filled me with terror. I was in bed, and I was like, during the night, I was in bed jumping about like a Mexican jumping bean with terror. If people had taken me 5 miles out of three and thrown me in, I couldn't have been worse. We had a big bain-marie, where you put vegetables and things in to keep them warm, and there was about 50 pinholes in it, and it went all over the floor. We had he did a hors d'oeuvre, and we had 115 people in, and there was only 55 hors d'oeuvre plates, so we had to wait till it was chaos. And we found there was so much wanted to do, and we had to renew the whole curtains, all the curtains in the house, and they hadn't got enough money. I had to borrow £1,000 from Bredner, and it wanted rewiring, replumbing, recarpeting, a new lift putting in. And in the kitchens there was teak sinks which you had to keep filled with water in the winter time so they wouldn't leak. and we spent tens of thousands of pounds on the Heysel, and we built it up, and after three years, we wouldn't take young men, and what was worse with the girls, we wouldn't take two girls if they came, you see. The only time we'd take two girls is they came with their parents, or like a girl would come with a girlfriend and their parents. And only when we could fit them, the girls, immediately on the room above them, on the floor above.
Was that because they might attract unsuitable young men to the hotel?
Well, you see, I'm not speaking about all the young girls we had, just about 99%, that's all. And you get two girls there, you couldn't get them out of bed in the morning. Chambermaids, difficult to do the room. They'd go out, say, at 11 o'clock at night. And then at about 12:30, they'd come back. We had a porch there at the Hydro with some of these wooden seats, oak seats. And they'd sit on there. And they would come with a couple of longer Tibetans, you know. And it would go up the five floors, and you could hear what they were talking about five floors above. It's amazing how the voice carries. And I always used to be up till 3 or 4 in the morning, you see, and I used to go out and tell them, would you mind coming in? Would you mind going over the road in the pavilion there? And laugh and shout as much as you like. You heard the deathly hush. That was when I said that. And I used to be in my trousers and singlets, you see. And they didn't answer. And I'd come in again, and 5 minutes afterwards, there was as much noise again. And with these garden seats on tiles, if you move them, it makes an awful noise. And then I'd go out and blow up my chest, and I put my fist hard and compress the nose of the one longer Tibetan and tell him in Dok language what would happen to him if he didn't clear off pronto. I'll tell my mother and father the way you talk of me. I said, you do, and I'll tell them what you're up to as well. And then after that, they'd come in, you see. They may be on the third floor. And you'd think they were in a barn in the middle of the Isle of Man, thumping and banging on the doors. I mean, a banging on the door during the day, you never hear, but in the middle of the night, drawers were opened, in and out, in and out, in and out. They go to the bathroom, shut that and bang, and laughing and chatting. I could hear them down in the office, two or three floors below. And then they go out again in a completely new rig out to meet two other fellows, you see, so the other chaps who'd been out with them for wouldn't recognise. Oh, you could fill books.
And you then said you could tell Mr. Kinsey a thing or two about life.
Well, there was, as I say, we didn't take young men, but we had to take them until about the third year, until we got really busy. And when all these married couples knew that we didn't have this trouble with the young fellows, you see, we got more business still, because you could go into some houses along the front and they couldn't care less. And the poor married couples who wanted to sleep, they got no sleep and no rest. It was a nightmare. Now, we had at least 15 young staff, and mainly from Southern Ireland, young girls, lovely young girls they were too. And if you got four or five young fellows there, or even 10, they'd be roaming around at night and they're trying to seduce the girls and mess around and knock on the doors, disturb the other staff and the visitors. They were in. Anyway, we had a lady ring up, a very nice voice from Lancashire, and she wanted to know if we had a twin bedded room for such and such a date in May. I said, yes, certainly. Oh, she said, will you reserve it for me? I said, yes. Well, she said, I'll send you a deposit. No, I said, don't do that. I'll send you a brochure with a booking form. And if you'll fill it in and send it me back. I said, we don't take deposits. We don't ask for a deposit. And she said, that's strange, isn't it? Well, I said, it is, but I said, I'm the office worker. I do all the office work, and if I've got to give receipts for this, it only makes the work. And I said, if anybody books and they don't come, we sue them, you see. But everybody books, I said, with the intention of coming, you see. And in my literature, when I send the confirmation of the booking and they haven't sent a deposit, there's a PTO, and in larger black print, there's the circumstances that if they don't come, you see, without warning or give me enough warning, that that the account will be put in charge of the solicitor, so they'll know. I don't mind if they cancel, as long as they let me know a week beforehand. But if they book and just don't turn up, well, that's something I don't stand for. And I've found out that, of course, I've been to the solicitor, the boarding house solicitor, and they've tried and tried and not got the money. So through the solicitor again, I've got the name and address of the nearest collecting agency in the area where they are, and I've given him the account as a present. And he'll be on the doorstep and he'll get the money off. He's going to be for nothing. So they won't have finished with me. And I said that if they don't come, supposing they're booked on the Saturday and they haven't come, on the Sunday I've got that room full, because the tourist board know the quality of the hydro we had, and they'd fill me up, you see. So I didn't lose anything.
What other techniques would you use to make sure the hotel was run efficiently and well?
Well, it's a combination of a great many things, really. For instance, in the dining room, we had tables, square tables, where you'd seat four people. Slightly oblong, rectangular tables, you'd have two on the one side and two on the other. And when they got very busy, they'd have one at the end as well. Now, as the tables spread across the dining room, the passageways were filled up, and it was difficult for the waitresses to get round. So at the end of the season, I lengthened the tables so that we got three on each side, which gave me that extra space, extra accommodation, and whereas we could only seat 120 in the dining room before, we seated 180 with far greater ease. Mind you, we hadn't got tables for two and that sort of business, and we didn't do a la carte, and at the same time, we didn't charge a la carte prices. We were dealing with a mass of people who were carefree and came over for the holiday. They didn't want to sit down and spend half an hour ordering. Now, if you get six people at the table and you've got a la carte, the one lady said, what are you going to have, Winnie? What soup are you going to have? Tomato soup or brown Windsor. Well, I had that. So what are you having? And by the time you got the order for the soup, I said, you could serve half the dining room. And I said, these people, on a beautiful summer's day, which it used to be in those days, the people used to come in 180, waiting in the lounge, on the stairs, in the hallway, for the bells to go. And when we went, it was like a tremendous surge forward, you see. And they wanted to be served promptly and efficiently, and they wanted to get out again. They didn't want to be hanging about. Now, in the place like the Castle Mona, where they did a la carte, you got a different type of people, and they charged twice as much as what we did. But the people, as long as they can eat beef and pork and lamb, and we did a menu, for instance, in the morning, we started off in lovely silver goblets with grapefruit, and it was whole slices, not chopped grapefruit, and topped up with the fluid. And then they had bacon and egg, and preceded, if they wished, by cornflakes or porridge. And it's not if you had the porridge, you can't have the cornflakes or anything like that, you could have everything. And as different from the classiest hotels today, if you go to the classiest hotels today, they will put on toast on the table when you have breakfast, but they'll omit the bread and butter. But with us, the bread and butter, the toast, and the sauces, everything was on the tables, pepper and salt, so they didn't have to waste time asking the waitresses, and also the waitresses didn't have to waste time going round getting extra orders, you see.
So would you plan quite carefully your improvements in the winter time, and would you sit and think, now, how can I make this hotel more efficient, you know?
Oh yes, we did. For instance, in the front lounge, which is a fairly big front lounge, all the walls round about were grooved and dug in at about a height of 4 foot by the chairs, the backs of the chairs knocking into it. So at the foot of the walls, a foot from the bottom of the wall and 5 inches high, we put tongue and grooved oak platform all the way round. And it was highly polished with polyurethane, so you never had to touch it, only give it a wipe. And when the chair's wheels hit that, it kept it off the walls, and then we repaired the walls and redecorated. In the dining room, which we used to seat 180, and of course in those days, smoking was prevalent. You could go in that smoke room just after a meal, and you could cut off a square foot of it and wrap it up in brown paper, it was so thick. And I'll have to do something about these. So on the windows, which went over the back outlet, and there were beautiful coloured stained glass windows, I put window openers. You've seen on the school, in schoolrooms, where they've got these cords, on that principle. And so, of course, I used to open these just before a meal, and as soon as the people sat down, they used to shut them. So the next year, I improved on that. I did what they do in hospitals. I got a long steel rods and gearing with a handle, and I wound them open, and the lock came open all at once, you see, and then I took the handle away, so they couldn't do anything about it, except complain. And but they accepted it in the end, but even that it didn't seem to do the trick. Now, the ceiling of the hydro was a beautiful ceiling. It was in about 2.5 foot squares and all encrusted molding plastering, beautifully done. And it was kind of yellow with the tobacco stains. And one of the first jobs in the winter time was to get three of these tables on top of each other, because the ceiling was very high, and secure the tables on top of each other with blocks so that they wouldn't shift off when you were moving about, and get a tall pair of step ladders. And then we used to clean every square with the polywash, a soap cleaner. And it was marvellous. You used to rub it on. There's no hard work with it. It took time, of course. And then in the middle of the dining room, we put in 4 12-inch Ventaxia fans. And, of course, the floorboarding, we took the floorboardings up on the floor above. And there was quite a gap between the floorboard and the ceiling. And we took it across the first landing corridor into a small room, which I use as a workshop. And I converted it and shelved it and put in a bench and a vice, which I made and put all my tools in there. And there was a girder ran through that. I did used to use it as a bedroom. And we took the windows out and inserted these four extractor fans, four outlets there. The fans themselves were in the ceiling, and the air went along this passage and out through the wall into the backyard. And if you wore a hat in the dining room, I wouldn't say to lift it up and suck it out, but it very nearly did. And you could go in there after a meal and you would see no smoke whatsoever, nothing. I mean, it did have a little bit of one or two odd complaints, because obviously you can't move all that much air without a bit of draft coming. So anyway, that was that. But and then we put curtains on the we did pink net curtains in draped over and folded over the windows, and they looked really nice, you know, they really did. And then the people in the dining room, you can imagine 180 people eating in the dining room with the clatter of the knives and forks and the talk and the plates. If you were a lion, you couldn't hear yourself roar. But even then, the people couldn't hear themselves talk because of the noise in the still room where the food was being served out. All the clatter of the plates and the dishes being washed and the cutlery and the girls shouting to each other. It was terrific. So the next job then I had to do was to soundproof the still room from the dining room, which we did. We built something round, soundproofed it, and we had two swing doors, one for going in and one for coming out. It didn't cut all the sound out, but it cut out about 90% of it. It was bearable, you know. Now, we had old gas hot plates when we were in there, and when you lit them in the morning, you had to lie horizontal on the ground to see what you were doing, and the smell of them and the greasiness. Anyway, I replaced those with three stainless steel hot plates, and each of them were 6 to 8 feet long, two shelves, and when we put in, of course the meat had to be cut up in advance, and we had to put it in the hot plate, and we put these aluminium rings on top of each other, and they'd only hold three plates on top of each other. And although I got three hot plates, I hadn't got enough real room to put in the veg and all the meats and things, unless I could get four plates on top of each other. So I went to a pal of mine, Billy Ingalls, who had a machine shop in Back Strand Street, and I took him about 300 of these aluminium rings, and I said, "Look, Bill," I said, "will you just cut off the rim off all these? That'll take off about 3/16 of an inch off each one, and times four, you see, and I could just get in four then on top of each other." And it didn't alter the dinner, it didn't affect that at all. And then I put on the one big hot plate where we put in the plates for breakfast. We all of us know when we've travelled around, we've had cold plates and cold meals. And I was determined that my plates were going to go in so the girls can just hold them, you see. They're so hot that they were half a degree hotter, they wouldn't be able to pick them up. And so I put time switches on these hot plates, and they cut in at 8 o'clock in the morning and cut off at 9:30 in the morning. They cut in early in the afternoon for the when we had a hot meal midday, and then at night. So they were cutting in, cutting out. Now that cut out work for the staff. They didn't have to think. They just put the plates in the night before. Now then, in those days, the summers used to be very, very hot. And I used to think, I was in America once, and when they served beer, they always served a glass of cold water, real cold water. If you had tea, they'd serve you cold water as well, if you drank it or not. And I thought, that's marvellous. How can I serve cold water? So I thought, right, I'll do that. So I got a firm over here, an electrical firm, and I got a cylinder, It was about a 10 gallon cylinder, and I told them what I wanted. I wanted to freeze the water in it with a thermostat on it where I could take it just a few degrees above freezing. And at the bottom, I had a 1-inch tap. Now, if you go, or used to go anywhere for a 1-inch tap, they give you a 1-inch tap. But it wasn't a 1-inch tap, it wasn't even a 1/2-inch tap. To my idea, a 1-inch tap is a 1-inch bore coming in all the way through and going out. But where you ordinarily buy a 1-inch tap and you take it apart, the middle hole is only 1/2 inch. And I insisted that I got a 1-inch tap. So they put a quart jug in front of it, and they just had time to turn the tap on and turn it off, and it was full. And the girls there, the one girl, the head girl in the dining room, would be operating the handle, and the girl who was taking the waitress would have two jugs, or perhaps three, if she was smart enough. And and we never used to take the water in until the gongs went. So when the people were coming in, the water was going in, and it was absolutely cold. It was about 4 degrees above freezing. Well, now, when I designed this and I told the man what I wanted, he eventually delivered it, but he didn't do it as I wanted it. He put a ball cock in the top, so that when the girls were pulling the water out at the bottom, water was coming in, like in a toilet system, up above. And that meant that virtually, although it's a cold water that was coming in, virtually to me it was hot water coming in. So after he'd gone and left, I took all this apart and did my own bit of plumbing. And I put in the tap, I put in a pipe straight from the cold water main with a stop tap on the outside. Now, this water in this tank was enough to serve the dining room twice. So if the head girl in the dining room, in the storeroom, forgot to fill the water up again, it'd definitely do for the next meal, you see. And then the rule was that when the girls had finished taking in the water, this tap would be turned on, and there was an overflow tap, overflow pipe, which came down into the side of the sink, so it didn't do any harm to anybody. And when the girl heard this water coming in the sink, she just turned the tap off, which is hat to hand, and that worked a bomb. Mind you, we didn't serve so much beer and stuff, but we didn't mind that because we were doing what they wanted, you see.
How did other hoteliers react to your sort of progressive attitude? Did they think that it was a good thing, or was some of them, you know, did they not think it was worth it?
Well, the man, the hotelier next door to me, he came into me one day and he was horrified. Because I had 20 men in the stillroom. It was their morning break, and we used to open a half tin of biscuits, and we used to eat the whole half tin in the minute break, you see. But he was horrified at the number of men, and they were there all winter, but there was so much to do, and this went on for years until we got the place as we call right. And when we got the place right, I found in the Grasmere, that I shouldn't be saying this really, but I used to go and buy 100 weight of sugar black market, £9. You wouldn't buy for £9 now. And every table, it had the sugar bowl full of sugar. This is just after the war, a couple of years after the war.
Did you come? You came into the trade at just after the war.
After the war. And then I used to. I met a chap once, and we got to chatting when we got friendly, and he said he had a chicken farm up in Jerby, Andreas somewhere. And I said, how do you fix for eggs? Oh, well, he said, got eggs, he said. Anyway, the upshot of it was, I went up in the car, and he had an ex-RAF hut in the middle of a field, a huge field, And he had hundreds of hens there, and they were all Rhode Island Reds, if I remember right, because any number of the eggs we used to get were double yolked. And they used to go up there and get 360 eggs at a time, a case. And in the winter time, or when they first started in the spring, he had great difficulty in selling his eggs. And I used to get three dolly tubs, the old dolly tubs, and I'd put eggs down for the summer. And he was very, very grateful for that, and I was too, because I got them very much cheaper, and I put them down in icing glass or whatever it is we used to do, and they were perfect when they came out, and they soon went. Now, the men, we had 68 in the dining room, and of course there was a staff, and we used to give the men bacon and eggs, two eggs every morning.
The male visitors?
The male visitors, and the ladies bacon and egg. If they wanted two eggs, they could have two eggs. And we use a tremendous amount of eggs, of course. And I remember the man next door, Billy Saville. They can't summon him now, he's dead. And he was in with a farmer, and he used to buy a cow every so often, or half a cow. And I got half a cow one day, and it was on the back kitchen floor, which is a stone floor, and I got three or four boarding house people there having some of it, because it was too much for me. And my brother-in-law happened to be a butcher, and we had the big scales, you know. and the butcher came in with a week's supply of meat, which was a few pound of meat and a round of beef, and he came down the back kitchen steps. He was a character, that chap. And he opened the kitchen door and he saw all this babble going on and all this meat on the floor, and he got his meat and he threw it in the middle. And he said something going out, which I can't repeat, of course, what he said, but he didn't report it or say anything. You had to do your best, you see, and I found that if I spent a few pounds a week extra on food, you see, I'd more than get the return in the visitors, and it paid off. And I was able to get more selective with the visitors, and instead of taking all sort of odd days and having the day empty with the room empty, which was unprofitable, we used to fill up. But as I say, you pick up the ideas here and there. And then I went to Mills Waverley once. I don't know why I went there, I have no idea, but I was down in their kitchens.
And, what year would this be?
Pardon?
What year would you have been doing that?
39, this would be about 49 or 50, in 1950. And it was a big kitchen there. It was a bit gloomy, a bit dark, but there was a roaring sound. I said, what's that? Well, that's the boiler. Well, what's that for? Well, that's for the hot water. Well, what's it burn? Burns oil. Oh, well, that's good. And because we had a boiler which is in the back kitchen, and it had to be stoked up with anthracite, and you got to watch it all the time. And we used to get it nearly white hot. But when you've got every bedroom going, and people, when they're away, they're not water conservationists, they're a bit on the extravagant side. And they leave the taps running and things like that. So I thought, I wonder if I could get an oil-fired boiler for the Grasmere. And I inquired off the plumber, and he inquired off somebody else. He said, yes. So we had a little outhouse at the top of the backyard, and we put this fuel burner in there. It wasn't very, very big. And we had a 250-gallon tank on the roof, and it was, but my word, was it efficient. And it used to give a real hot water, and I put in an extra tank to contain extra hot water, so when 68 people got up in the morning, they all wanted to wash, they were all using the hot water, you see. It was a bit different in the hydro. We had the same problem there, of course. We hadn't got enough hot water. And we had put in an extra half a dozen bathrooms. We hadn't got anywhere en suite in those days. They have now, of course. And we found that the baths we had, we'd put them in, they were too generous in the size. And when people used to have a bath, they used to be able to drown in it quite easy. They put it right to the top, nearly, to the plug hole. So, that it behold me, we had to put in a new boiler. And it was glass-lined, a new burner. And then we put in another huge header tank up in the loft. And we had trouble in turning the water around. I wanted to take the water from downstairs as quick as we could. So I bought a big pump from Rowe Brothers, now Todd and Elliot's. They used to be in Duke Street. And the chap there, he's still alive now. I was speaking to him the other day. He's retired many years. Greg Coulter, and he was the boss there, and I bought this huge pump, and it broke down. So I took it back after a week, and he said he never couldn't understand it. Gave me another one, and after a few days, that broke down, and he couldn't understand it, you see. Well, it never happened before. And I got to thinking about this. Because if you have a scaffolding pole, you say 70 foot high, which is the height where the tank would be, and you try to lift that up, my word, you'd have a job. And if you're trying to lift up 70 foot of water, you've got a tremendous load to shove up. And I thought, well, it'd be just as simple to pull the water down, to suck it down. So we turned the pump the other way, and it went like clockwork, no bother at all. So I went and told Greg. I said, I'll tell you what the trouble was.